Ronan Fraser is one of my favourite serial entrepreneurs on the planet. He has his finger in dozens and dozens of pies. And by pies, I mean businesses. He actually teaches how to buy businesses with no money out of pocket. But otherwise, Roland is an incredibly generous entrepreneur, generous with his time, generous with his advice. And he came onto the Smarter Destiny podcast and dropped bombs. He is an incredibly successful, humble individual. And this episode is one of my favorites. Buckle up and enjoy.
I always feel hungry and discontentedly satisfied. So it's cool, but I want to go to the next level always, always, always.
We're on a mission. We're going to find and uncover the smartest, most successful entrepreneurs on the planet, explore their highs, their lows, and how they ultimately mastered the game. I'm Martin Cook, and I'm excited to welcome you to the Smarter Destiny podcast. I'm grateful for you and your time. Now let's level up together. Ladies and gentlemen, hello and welcome to another Smarter Destiny podcast. This time I have my friend Ronan Fraser, and I'm super excited. You have probably, unless you live under a rock with noise-cancelling headphones on, have heard about Roland. You probably know him from the stages at Digital Marketer. Perhaps you've heard or listened to his podcast. Perhaps you've seen one of the many, many gems that he shares on social media, like in his spare time, for fun, just giving value and what. The guy is super humble. He has been successful, talented, and winning all kinds of things that are thrown at him, and you'll see what I mean in the upcoming interview. I am absolutely thrilled and gratified to welcome Roland to this interview, and cannot wait to pull at the threads that make him up. Roland, how are you?
I'm fantastic, Martin. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Do you notice how we did that whole interview without saying the number 4 billion?
I did notice. Yeah, I love it. I think that's a good way to go.
I think we'll just leave that hanging as a little bit of a tease for what's going to come up. And where does 4 billion in terms of revenue sit in this conversation? We'll find out. Sound good?
That sounds great.
Sounds good. So where are you coming from today? Where are you based right now?
I am in North County, San Diego. It's a little cool little area called Rancho Santa Fe up in the northern part of San Diego County. We've got little white fences with trees hanging over them and horses crossing roads, and then ocean views in the background. It's a pretty cool place.
It sounds amazing. And more specifically, are you on the right-hand side or the left-hand side of your couch right now?
I am on the... Are you facing the couch or sitting on the couch when you're determined?
Should we say stage left?
Yeah, I was going to say, I am couch right now.
Couch right, okay. Just sat in the Roland ass print from years gone by, yeah? Something like that, and just super comfy.
I wish. I never seem to sit in the same place. It's wherever I fall, so not a big sitter.
a bit like an acorn. You sit like acorns. Acorns,
there you go.
If you get like my reference. Fantastic. So, Roland, I know that you have accomplished a tremendous amount in your career so far. And so we are undoubtedly going to uncover some cool stuff. Typically, as we had a little chat off air, and I love saying off air, by the way, but off air, we had a chat about a logical starting point for this journey, this experience that we're going to be on together. And what we really love to do is to go back to the time of the entrepreneur when they were perhaps transitioning out of a less entrepreneurial or totally not entrepreneurial role into an entrepreneurial role. So casting your mind back to that time as a starting point, do you see a little opening for us to start exploring?
I do. It was quite a long time ago because I have been an entrepreneur for a long time now. So it would be operating as a skate rental clerk at the Golden Skate World roller skating rink in Richmond, Virginia.
Wow. That's a long title. And what was your role at that place?
skate rental clerk. So SRC. SRC sounds better. If I put Roland Fraser, SRC, no, it sounds very official, but it's really just skate rental clerk.
And you were in charge, presumably, of issuing skates, is that?
I was not in charge, but I was one of the people who was able to issue skates at that time, yes. I was 16 years old, and I was working in a program that allowed them to pay high school students less than minimum wage. We have a minimum wage here. I don't know if you guys do or not. But and so they could pay 60% of minimum wage. So it was a very low-paying job, but it was fun because they played all kinds of cool music and lots of girls were there. So it was kind of a process of working, earning money, and potentially meeting girls as a high-level skate rental clerk executive.
Fantastic. And of course, you never abused your power at being in charge of the skates.
Not even once. Never. No.
Okay. So you were 16. And
an incidental skill that I did learn was that I could guess, and still to this day, can guess pretty much anyone's shoe size just by looking at it.
Well, that is a party trick and a half.
It is, right? Yeah.
Surely you've been tempted to get yourself a pair of those wheelie trainers at some point as well. Wheelie sneakers.
Yes, I have not, but they're cool. I do enjoy rollerblading, but anyway.
Okay, so you're at this time, and some sort of light or opportunity presented itself. Some sort of inner voice started speaking to you, and you wanted a change. You wanted a transition. Could you talk to us a bit about that?
Well, I was already an entrepreneur. Because I would, I had an older friend who would buy liquor for me, and I would keep it in my trunk and sell it to my friends in high school from the trunk of my car. So that was my first entrepreneurial venture. So I was doing that while working at Golden Skate World. But, ultimately, as soon as I turned 18, I had to be 18 in order to get a license to sell real estate, which was the first thing that I wanted to do. So that was kind of a very, very brief time. I had three jobs as an employee. I was an assistant tennis pro. I was a skate rental clerk, and I was a water slide gatekeeper, like the person at the top that gives people the, you can go down now. So
all very active, very outdoorsy positions.
Very sporty.
It's very sporty. Are we to assume that the young Roland Fraser, and maybe the current Roland Fraser, but at least the young Roland Fraser had a very, very defined six-pack back then?
That's not been in my genetics. No matter how thin I got, I could never do that. So I would like to. I like the idea, but if I do the like the 300 movie thing where you get somebody to airbrush them on, I think that it would probably work just fine. I've seen an infomercial product. The infomercial product is like the top of a grill from like that you barbecue on. You press it really tight into whatever you do have down there, and it leaves marks. So those, I could get them that way, I think, too.
I think that sounds a lot easier than sort of 10,000 crunches.
Yes, it definitely does. Definitely. I like that. It's a hack.
It's a life hack right there.
Hack, as it were.
An app hack. And so you're obviously enjoying swapping time for money and meeting people at this age, and this is building into is it like a college thing or like an apprenticeship type thing to get the real estate license? Or
no, you just had to go and sit for the exam and pass the exam. I had to take a course. I went for a weekend and took the course and then took the test, and then once you have that, you just go to a real estate place and hang your license. So that was kind of my transition but I never intended, obviously, to be. I also played in bands, so I played keyboards. I started playing out in clubs when I was 15. So I would work, I would go to school, I would work afternoons, and then I would typically play from 9 till 1 or 10 till 2 at night. And I made a lot more money playing in bands than I ever did working those three little jobs. But I didn't work those jobs for very long either. I played music from 15 to about 42. So wow. quite a lot of years doing that.
Wow. Okay. So we definitely want to pick that up. And do you mind me asking how old you are now?
I am 55.
55. Good. Mm-hmm. Thank you. I thought I was going to be a little bit awkward for a moment. You sort of say, mind your own business and hang up on me. And that would have been a short podcast, probably the shortest we've done, actually. So thank you for playing along. Okay. All right. So now you've, I'm going to assume you crushed the exam and now you're in a real estate offer, realtor office somewhere with the thing hung up on the wall behind you, the certificate. Proudly, and
never did that, but we can assume that. Yes, okay,
we can assume that somewhere somewhere nearby, maybe with a coffee cup on top of it or something. The desk, something like that. Okay, and so you're now selling houses. You've realized your dream, or have you?
Oh no, not at all. Just was a way to go about. It was an entree into a world I was very interested in, which was real estate. Real estate development, that sort of thing. So it kind of got me plugged into a community that I was that I desired to be part of, because I saw people making money, making a lot of money in terms of real estate commissions. So I saw that that was a good way to go about it.
Okay, and so was that the main driver at this stage?
Yeah, it was. It was basically I wanted to get out there and do something. I really liked real estate. I had a copy of a book from a guy named Robert Allen that wrote a book called Nothing Down. It was how to buy real estate with no money down. I just thought that was fascinating. I wanted to learn more about it, so I figured I'd get into that niche.
Fantastic. And so at this point, are you your own boss in this office, or do you have bosses?
No, you're an independent. So basically, everything is up to you. You make they say you eat what you kill. So whatever you sell, you get commissions on. You give that to the office, because they have the broker's license, which it takes a while to. You have to be a real estate agent for a while before you can be a broker. But that was my first, other than playing in bands, which was its own entrepreneurial venture. But that was my first real official job that was like an entrepreneur, if that makes any sense.
Absolutely. So was this like by day you're selling houses, and by night you're thrilling thousands with your musical talents type thing?
Yeah. I think the most people we ever played for was like maybe 5,000 people. It was usually like playing in clubs. So you go to a club and there's, 400 or 500 or 700 people there. And, that was a lot of fun though.
And so are we talking like nightclubs, dance music, those kind
Correct.
Of clubs, and you're playing the sort of percussion or the actual words? You're playing along with the actual beat, but live, so if you like, that sort of thing.
Yeah, we were performing the music live. So I played in cover bands where you play other people's music. I played in original bands where we played our own music. I played keyboards, and then I would play bass on the songs that didn't have a really hard bass, because the keyboards are kind of tethered to a fixed stand, and the bass player and I would switch places because he had a wireless bass, so he could go out into the audience, which was always lots of fun. And so that was, that was a ton of fun.
I imagine so. Did you ever crowd surf?
That did not ever crowd surf. No, that didn't. I missed out on that. That's more of a lead vocalist kind of thing.
Oh, is it?
I think.
Okay.
But it was a ton of fun. I mean, we played lots of interesting places, from military bases to high school dances to marine dances to just nightclubs and then discos and all kinds of fun things. So it was an interesting adventure.
Wow. I imagine. Actually, fun side effect, I worked in nightclubs for 7 years myself. I understand the scene. And the fun that goes along with it, aside from playing the music that you love. But this spotlight back on you. So by day selling houses, by night entertaining thousands. I think it's apt. Talk me through, like, how long were you on this real estate journey for?
Real estate, I did solely for about a year. I got my real estate license when I was 18. I quickly identified that I wanted to be able to sell faster than going and getting a listing at a time. And then, because typically as a real estate agent, you go out, you meet people, you network, and then occasionally somebody says, hey, I'd like you to sell my house. And I was like, well, who has lots of houses to sell? Because I don't really want to just sell one house at a time. So, okay, developers have lots of houses to sell. They build entire neighborhoods and they have to sell all of those houses. So I started going to developers and saying, you know, well, let me sell houses for you. That gave me the leverage of having to only have a few clients but still have a lot of listings. Then when I started talking to them about how they did it, I said, you know, how do you do this whole thing? They're like, well, you buy land and then you go and file papers and then you get to divide it up into, you know, lots, and we sell lots and then we build houses. And I was like, well, that's kind of cool. How do you get the money to do that? And they said, well, two ways. One is we get them from the banks, but usually more often we go to private investors and we do these things called syndications. So we create a limited partnership and we act as the kind of the person running it called the general partner, and we get investors to put money in and they are limited partners. And I said, well, that's interesting. Tell me about that. And they said, well, I said, how does it work? And they told me, and I said, can I help? And they said, well, you have to have a license to do that. And they said, well, okay, what kind of license? They said, well, it's a security. So you have to get a securities license. And I said, okay, that's cool. And by the way, we also have to have key man insurance in case something happens to us so that insurance pays the investors if we get hit by a bus or something. And I said, okay, cool. I will go and get the insurance license so that I can sell you the key man insurance. I'll give you a deal on that. And then I will go get my securities license so I can go find investors for you and get paid commissions on that, because that sounds even better than selling houses. And so I got my insurance license when I was 19, my securities license when I was 20. So I was kind of putting all of those things together. And then I saved my money and basically invested with one of those developers to do my first investment. I forget exactly how much it was, but I remember I at least doubled my money. I think it was like $12,000 or something like that. And then I got back like $39,000 a year later. And I was like, this is amazing. I want to do this all the time. So it was kind of an incremental entry into that world and just getting as many of the qualifications and as many of the contacts and as many of the experiences as I could to become immersed in it and be good at it. And I thought it was fun too.
Wow. And I love that. I love how you've identified where the people with the houses are, and they've gone in and then you've spoken to them, you know, like the next level up on the ladder. Like, how are you guys doing it? Okay, that's interesting. How would I go about getting that? And then you've got that. And then, okay, how are you guys doing that, to the point where you've actually at the age, well, at the very least, very, very young 20s. Probably these people now that you're rubbing shoulders with are significantly older than you. Perhaps mm-hmm. you're shattering a few youngest property development people type records already at this stage.
It has been weird because I was always significantly younger than all of the other people that were around me. And now I am probably 50-50 that 50% of the people I'm around are younger than me and 50% are older. So it's kind of funny when that change happens, you know, as like, you know, hey, I'm always the, you know, yeah, you're the kid. And then it's, you know, it's, oh, okay.
And which did you prefer? Which do you prefer?
Oh, it's all good, man. I just like people. I like having a diverse slice of people demographically around me. I think that, you know, I didn't identify with what the younger people when I was young were into. They were super into playing on the high school teams. I played tennis, but like, you know, they were football and they'd go to all the games and all that stuff. And I was like, man, I'd rather go make money. And, and then I was playing out. So like I had a whole social scene out in the clubs, you know, I'd go in and I to play, and then I'd walk out to go to the bathroom or get a drink or something. I'd try to get back in and they'd card me and they'd be like, you're not old enough to come in. And I'm like, no, I'm in the band, really. And they're like, yeah, right. I'm like, no, really am. Ask the guitar player, he'll tell you, you know. So I had a social circle outside of that. So it was just, and those guys were always older than me because, you know, they were obviously old enough to, you know, to go and have a drink before I was. So it just kind of, it is just kind of evolved that way. But I think it's good to have people all ages around.
Absolutely. And so let's pull at that particular thread. So why do you think you enjoy having a diverse surrounding of people around you?
I think that they all have different perspectives. So it's good to be plugged into all the different strata of, you know, digital native, Gen Z, Gen Y, Gen X, you know, baby boomer, et cetera, millennial. It's good to know those different groups and what they're interested in, especially if you're marketing to all those different groups, which, you know, through the companies I own, I am.
Absolutely. And you've developed the skill from a young age, almost by accident, or?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, so you're now not just selling houses, you're actually building houses and selling houses and partnering with property developers. Mm-hmm. At a very young age. It sounds like you're probably just about legal now to drink at this point. You can sell houses but can't drink, irony, weird. Mm-hmm. But okay, so you're now on this path, and where does this path begin to take you from this point? Like, how are you feeling about your success? How are you feeling about your direction?
I always feel hungry and discontentedly satisfied. So it's you know, it's like, it's cool, but I want to go to the next level always. So I felt good about it. I was in school also. So, you know, when I got out of high school, I went to college. I got a degree in accounting and then went on to law school. As I was going through that, I was still playing in bands and I was still working. And I basically moved from real estate to companies as a result of having the securities license. I got introduced to some people at Prudential Securities in New York. And at the time, this was in the 1980s, leverage buyouts were very big. And so I was able to play in that field and just really loved the idea of buying and selling companies. And you could do it on, it was so much more interesting to me than real estate. And the potential upside was dramatically larger as well.
I imagine. Okay, so let's shine a magnifying glass on this particular moment. So you've realized you've hit maybe a bit of a glass ceiling with the real estate development, perhaps just developing bigger plots? No, or
it just wasn't as interesting. I think if I had stuck with it, I could probably have made a whole lot of money, done a great career at it, and had a nice time. But it was not the thing for me. It wasn't what I wanted to do long term. I still am involved in real estate and lots of different ventures, but you know, as a builder developer, it's a tough world because it's very cyclical. You can see that there's lots and lots and lots of money to be made, and then if you can't spot when the change is coming and get out quickly enough, then you can lose everything. So it's a very volatile world. So it just was, to me, there was too much risk inherent with that, and I also found the other thing way more interesting.
And so how did you come across the other thing?
It was just basically, like I said, through that relationship with having that securities license. And I had the opportunity to get involved with a company that made machines that processed agricultural products, and got involved with that and met professional management teams through that. And then I had somebody at Prudential that kind of took me under their wing and showed me the ropes of how all that stuff worked. And then it was just basically through networking opportunities started coming, and I would say, you know, hey, you could do this and this, and you know, they'd say, oh, okay, well, can you help me with it? And I'd say yes, and it just kind of took off that way. You know, I've an avid reader, have been since I was very, very young, reading business biographies and business books and things like that. And so with a business background, an accounting degree, and eventually a law degree, that all kind of, you know, you can't help but really get involved in that stuff. You always have opinions, no matter who you're talking to. If you're at a sandwich shop, and you're like, you know, you could do this differently. And what if you did this and this and this? You know, so
I can imagine. And so, yeah, might as well make money from those opinions. And so, for the watchers and listeners that don't necessarily fully understand what a leveraged buyout is, can you explain roughly what the process is?
Yeah, sure. It's basically just a way of acquiring a company through the assets that the company have that have built up in value. So you go and get a large loan to support buying the company based on real estate or accounts receivable or purchase orders or equipment or other assets and things of value that the company has. So you pledge those assets to the creditor. The creditor gives you a bunch of money, and then you buy the company. Effectively, you buy the company with its own money.
Sounds Phenomenal. And so is there a specific example of a company that I'm sure, I mean, first off, when we're talking these kind of deals, roughly how many have you made so far in your career?
Of different deals, hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands at this point. But, you know, of leverage buyouts, you know, I don't know, probably not as many of those, maybe 20, 30.
Okay. And so why is that? Was this another sort of short-lived career stepping stone? And that's the reason for the lower number? Or
no, I think it's just it's the spirit of the times, you know, different things are popular for a while, and then new, you know, so leverage buyouts are popular, and then recaps are popular, and then venture capital is popular, and then growth capital is popular. And it's like, and the financial world has evolved quite a bit over those years too. So there are lots more vehicles now to do different things. And so leverage buyouts kind of turned into more asset-based lending, ABL, they call it. And then there's all kinds of niche providers of these credit things that didn't exist before. So it's been fun to watch all of that happen. But for me, I generally don't like institutional financing because it's too cumbersome. So I like to buy companies with no money down. You know, I've got several ways to do that I practice. And so I don't really need debt from institutions. So it's just not something that as you get in and learn kind of how to do things more efficiently that fit your model of what you want to do, you know, certain things aren't as applicable.
Okay. And so what skills...
Did that answer that okay for you? I didn't want to...
I'm gonna go with about 70% went over my head, but that 30% that did hit home really, really... really rocked, but that's fine because I'm going to fill in the blanks. Hopefully over the next question. Okay. What I want to understand is what skills or habits or something in your DNA that made you really, really good at this. What do you think that was?
I think that for everyone, it's got to be a hunger to learn and an ability to analyze what has happened and what you can take away from that to improve the next time, to iterate better. I think that's really critical. I'm good with numbers and I'm good with law because those are things that I studied. So those are really helpful skills. But just innately, I think it's a love for puzzles. That's, I guess, what it would be. I'm a guy that liked word problems in math class, you know, when everybody was like, I hate word problems. I was like, I love word problems, you know. So I like complicated things that are story-based that you apply rules to come out with some sort of conclusion.
Okay, and so is that the way you tend to approach all problems with the, I need to find this solution and work backwards from it?
Yeah, I would say the first thing is to say, In law school, they teach you a thing called IRAC. It's spot the issues, then apply the rules to identify the rules that apply, analyze them, and come to a conclusion. IRAC, right? So that I think that's a good way to go. If you put the conclusion in front and say this is the conclusion I want to get to, then you might be misled. So I don't like to start with the end in mind. When I'm first starting to address a problem, I like to look at the issues and see what kinds of potential possibilities the issues present for a conclusion. Then when I've identified the conclusion that I like the best, I'll work backwards from that to get there. Does that make sense?
That does make sense. And so what kind of issues might a company that you're considering buying with its own money, or in some kind of way acquiring or adding your abilities, strength, weight, network, and connections to make it more valuable, what kind of eye the issues might that business be having, or what kind of issues might bring you into this opportunity?
Yeah, so more often than not, it is growth oriented. So what I am really good at is I'm good at business strategy. I'm good at identifying growth opportunities and then actually making them happen. Growth through partnerships, strategic relationships, and acquisitions are in particular things that I'm really good at. So I usually look for companies that can benefit from those things, that are already profitable, that are already growing, but that are ready to kind of take the 10x, 100x jump, and then thinking about an exit as far as how can they sell and then go do other things. So I like to find companies that I can pour my value into on those, you know, on those specific fronts. Usually they're not companies that are having trouble. They're not companies that are losing money. They might be companies that need team members, that need some reorganizing as far as how the founders and their current team are working with each other. Those are big opportunities as well. Or they may be a company that's getting ready to go into something, like a company I just got involved with is getting ready to go into franchising, and it's new for them, and I have experience with that, and I also have a path to help them do it way faster than the traditional method. So that's kind of a combination of those things.
Fantastic. And the company you just mentioned, is that the company where we dropped the 4B at the near the beginning of the interview?
It is.
Look at that. Yes. We closed the loop.
Yeah.
Good go us.
Well
played. Fantastic. Well played. Look how that happened. So I understanding so the issues really it's about slotting in pieces of the puzzle that you might have at your disposal, or seeing it from a different perspective, if you like, that begins to present an opportunity.
Yeah, I've identified over, you know, the time that I have been doing this now, I've got a 1KX, so 1,000X growth matrix. I've got 44 different points that I can hit on the revenue, profit, or valuation side. And so those three major components, revenue, profits, and valuation, are the things that I focus on. And then I have, you know, several things in each of those columns that are kind of my bag of tricks of things that I can do to really light up those particular areas. So I'll come in and then I have the benefit of that matrix to look at and say, here are all the places that we should focus. And then here are the things where I think we get the biggest benefit first. And then there's a system and a process for ranking the things, the different growth levers, what we're going to go after first. What are the initiatives we should start with? What are the resources we need in terms of team? What are the resources we need in terms of assets? And then how do we evaluate our performance?
And so you've done, as you've mentioned, you've done hundreds, if not thousands, of these, and presumably, using the cliche, presumably at this point, there's more pies than fingers available to put in them.
Yeah, for sure.
So how do you manage all of that? So you've got all of these opportunities, all of these presumably founders, business owners, decision makers needing your time, needing your attention, wanting it. How do you manage that so that your head doesn't in fact explode?
It's a great question. I it has been a process, but what I have done is I only take on the things that are the once in a lifetime opportunity, because I like to say that the once in a lifetime opportunity comes along three or four times a year. So if you have not burdened yourselves with things that are not once in a lifetime opportunities, then you have bandwidth to take advantage of those when they present themselves. So what I do is I don't sell my time ever. I don't act as a consultant. I don't sit on the organizational chart of any of the companies that I'm involved with. I'm a strategic investor advisor. I'll sit on the board or the advisory board, but I don't want to work in the company as a job. And so that gives me, number one, a tremendous amount of free time for the companies that I'm working with, because the things that we're focused on when we have a meeting are, here's our initiative. We'll do a planning day and I can say, here's all the stuff that we should look at. We identify who's going to do what. If it's a strategic partnership kind of thing or an acquisition, then I'll help, but that's a project, so I know how much time that's going to take. And then the rest of the time, those companies just run themselves. I mean, they're operators and integrators and team members that make that stuff happen, so I'm not involved in the day-to-day. And then in terms of the opportunities, to not drown in the opportunities, that's why I don't sell my time. So I will help anyone for free who I have time to help outside of my other stuff. And that's really cool because it allows me to give back. It doesn't force me to ever trade dollars for hours, which I don't want to do. I only devote my time in a compensated way to situations where I'm an owner. And so if someone wants more of my time than the free time that I have available, then we have a conversation about, does it make sense for me to become an owner? And is this something that fits the profile of the once in a lifetime opportunity that I'm, you know, that I'm looking for? And if it doesn't, then I just say, you know, hey, not now. I can't help right now. And I don't have to say no. I just say not now, which is easier. It's friendlier for them. And it's better for me because I don't feel like I'm missing out on something. It's, you know, well, maybe down the road, right? But people seem to have a pretty good understanding of that. So I can give a lot of value and they don't push hard because they don't have an ownership interest by paying me for my time. So if I say, you know, hey, I just don't have right time right now, I can talk to you next month, then that's got to be okay. And they either, you know, go find somebody else or they wait for the month and, or they say, well, actually, we'd really love to have you come in and, you know, be more involved. And then we have a conversation about that.
I like that. And so, and that's fantastic. And I think entrepreneurs, certainly every entrepreneur I've interviewed, every entrepreneur I've had a conversation with, we're all fighting with that sort of shiny object magpie syndrome to a certain degree. And sometimes it's about saying no, or actually more often than not, it's about saying no. So do you have any kind of 48-part matrix, perhaps, for identifying once-in-a-lifetime opportunities?
No, I think those just present themselves. I mean, I'm looking for something that, for me personally, will be worth a minimum of $10 million on exit, and that there is exit possibility within the next 3 to 6 years. That's kind of, if it's got those things, and I like the people, and I think it's going to be fun, then, you know, that becomes interesting to me.
Okay, fantastic. And we've identified perhaps what the opportunity looks like. And presumably sometimes you discover the opportunity without that person coming to you and saying, hey, I'd quite like you to be a part of this opportunity. Or is it normally they're approaching you?
Yeah, normally it's them approaching me because I have good deal flow just from all the things that I've done and the people that I know. So I see lots and lots of deals on a regular basis.
And is this in an informal, you're having a drink, you bumped into someone type thing, or are people actually sending you pitches?
No, people send me pitch decks, but I mean a lot more probably in the last few years in terms of the pitch decks, but those usually aren't things that turn into anything because it's very well identified by you and what you said. Everything is social. So the best deals, like the people I'm in business with now, I knew one of them for 3 years before we got in business. Another group of companies I knew for 6 years. Another one for 4 years, and one group of companies I started on my own. But the people that ultimately came in that are running them asked me to buy into the companies about 6 years in. So I'd known them for about 6 or 7 years. So it seems like, I'm trying to think if there's any, another group of companies was about 5 years. So I'd say that in most cases, it's people that I've known for 3 to 6 years that I get involved with because they know me well enough to know, shockingly enough, I have some imperfections. I don't know what they are, but other people tell me that I have.
Now, six pack, I think.
They get to know, you know, what, who I am and what I'm about, and I get to know them, and you know, we have a chance to know each other before we go into the deal. So, like pitch decks usually come about as a result of, you know, cold intros, and so I'm fortunate enough that. That my network provides me enough. And one thing that's really cool about that is that providing help to people and not asking anything for it is kind of a big deal because it does not infrequently turn into something that, you know, where somebody comes to you and says, I'd really like for you to be part of the business. So I might sit on the advisory board and have a small, you know, 2% stake in the company, or I might come in for something more significant and I might actually bring in capital as well and, you know, own 20 or 30 or 40% of the company.
Fantastic. And complete devout believer and follower of the wisdom of just give out value with no expectation of anything in return. And yep. Funnily enough, it often comes around. And,
yeah, it's the best. It's the most selfish thing you can do is to help other people. It's awesome.
It's the most amazing thing. And in case any of you have jumped through the filter of this particular podcast and there's actual dickheads listening, the reverse is true. The negative also is true, guys. So try be better. Be nice.
Yeah.
Be like Roland.
Karma.
Exactly. Karma. Fantastic. So is there a particular kind of company that you like to get involved in? Do you find yourself gravitating towards more brands or more software or more other things?
Yeah, it's really interesting. So right now I have a couple of e-learning companies. I've got several SaaS companies that I'm involved with. I've got a couple of training companies, a consulting company. I've got a real estate brokerage. It really goes across the board. I would say I am mostly B2B. I'm not very business to consumer. I like business to business events. I own a couple of events as well. So and everything I own with partners, because that allows me to do the things that I'm best at.
Absolutely.
But they do have, I mean, so if I'm looking for commonalities, I'd say, you know, they're typically over $5 million in revenue at the time that I come in. They are already established. They already are profitable. They're business to business. They have some component of recurring revenue, something where people are paying on a monthly or annual basis. They have multiple potential exits based on how we structure them. So I like to get involved in companies where it's not like we're going to build this one company and sell it, and if that doesn't work out, we didn't make any money. I'll give you a couple of examples. So Digital Marketer is a company I own with Ryan Dice and Richard Lindner. And we train people. We're an e-learning company, so we train people with the software as a service on, you know, marketing. And Digital Marketer has an event called Traffic and Conversion Summit, and it has a software that powers its publishing, and it has a media arm in that it has, you know, a million plus people that follow our marketing stuff. So we have a high-end thing called War Room, which is a mastermind, and we have, because of doing events, we have an event sponsorship company and an event logistics company. So what's cool about that is, if you think about that, now I've got the media company, Digital Marketer. I've got the event, which we just sold 80% of to a company out of the UK called Clarion Events. I've got War Room, which is the high-end mastermind. I've got the sponsorship company and the events logistics company, and three SaaSs, all in that one group of companies. So when I got involved in that, it was a publishing company, and it had an event that was a small event. And then we said, okay, here's how we can spin this into at least a six exit company. Real estate company, brokerage company, if that fails, maybe it will, maybe it won't, right? That's a good company. But if a real estate brokerage company has an audience of real estate agents that it serves, and it has an audience of buyers of homes that it serves, then it should also own media. So we bought a company that had lots of media, including a company that had lots of agents. And then we have a title company and an escrow company and a mortgage company and so on and so forth. So now we are building multiple companies from one group of customers at the same time. And if we want to sell Digital Marketer, we can sell Digital Marketer, but the smarter play, which is I think what we've started on, we had our first exit with in that group of companies selling Traffic and Conversion Summit. Now we've sold 80% of that. We own 20, but now if we 5X that company, which we will do in the next 2 to 3 years, then we're back where we started. Plus now we've got a really significantly larger footprint because we used somebody else's money to help grow that. They're happy because they got what they wanted, the event. But then it also supported as it went, you know, we'll go to Amsterdam in 2020 and into Asia in 2020 and to another into the East Coast of the United States in 2020. So let's say that we get those three events done in 2020. Now, on the back of the event, all of those other companies benefit. So we build the mastermind company, we build the SaaS, we build the e-learning, we build the, you know, the platforms that we've got are all supported by that first exit and increasing in value as a result of the increase in value of the minority interest that we still hold. So that's kind of a rant, but I hope that makes sense.
That was an amazing rant. That was like you'd pulled out your wand and you were just making magic and music at the same time. And I can kind of visualize how, you know, as one machine in this one machine in the engine, maybe one cog in the engine, I don't know, as one whatever gets bigger, the other whatevers also benefit from that, and it's gathering momentum and gathering speed, and that's fantastic. And so you touched upon the obviously your ownership or your stakeholdership, or however you want to however the correct way of saying it is, in Digital Marketer. Ownership's fine. Ownership doesn't imply sole ownership. Joint ownership, yeah, that's fine.
Yeah, correct.
That's fine.
Yeah.
That's fine for my simple ownership. Brain. That's fine.
Ownership is good.
Is there a story behind that? I mean, so presumably you weren't there from the beginning, right?
I was not. No, and there's only one group of companies right now that I was the founder of. So Digital Marketer happened as a result of going to the event that I just mentioned that we sold. I went to the very first one that they had. I was following the Digital Marketer guys online, and I said, you know, this seems like a great thing to take digital marketing to these companies that are not digitally inclined and then increase the value and sell them. So I should get to know these people. So I went to that event and was just blown away by the quality of the material there. And I wanted to get to know the people that were running it. And so I saw that I always look through for, you know, is there a paid channel of access to get close to these people? They had a paid channel for access. It was called the War Room Mastermind. I did not take advantage of it the first time because I didn't think I would have time to do it. But then I kicked myself for the whole year after that for not taking advantage of it. I joined it the second year, and then I made it a point to get to know. So I now had access in a small group of about 20 people who were in this mastermind to the owners, who at the time were Perry Belcher, Ryan Dice, basically said, I've got to get to know these guys. And so they had a thing called Wicked Smart, which is a contest where the people vote on the best thing that you've done that's actually proven to have results. And I was like, okay, well, I have to win that. So I went in and with the intention of winning, and I won it. And then they grabbed me and said, you know, hey, let's have dinner and we want to talk. And I was a member for about 3 years, just helping, giving them advice, you know, with the skill sets that I have from my business experience. And when their CEO, who had the option to acquire a third of the company, ended up exiting the company, there was the opportunity to come in, and they said, you know, hey, would you be interested in buying in? And I said, absolutely. And so I bought in then. And at that time, it was really a publishing company that had an event. And we took a look at the roles of everybody in the company. The two founders, Perry and Ryan, were kind of butting heads. And so we said, hey, well, how about if we separate the divisions and responsibilities into Digital Marketer and this other group called, which ultimately became Rival Media. And you guys each run one of those, and I'll help out with the War Room and the event thing. So immediately we had identified then four parts of the company. One that would be run by Ryan and Richard, called Digital Marketer, which was a publishing company, which ultimately we identified needed to become a recurring revenue company and then needed to become a software company. So that's what the evolution of that has been. And then Rival Media, which was our e-commerce that Perry ran, which he went and took, and then that partnered with Agora last year, and now Perry is running all of those and owns them. That's been spun out as well. and then Traffic and Conversion Summit as an event, which we built to a significant event from the, you know, from where it was when I first came in, and we sold that to Clarion Exit. So we got two exits there. And then the War Room Mastermind, which has grown from, you know, 20 people to now 200 and some. So it's been a fun, you know, thing. And then as each of those gets its own area, it splinters into more potential companies and more potential exits as well. So it's kind of a cool spider webby type thing.
I love this. And you're at the top with, you know, the puppeteer gloves or the sticks and just kind of I imagine you're, or maybe it's a game of chess is a better analogy here, but either way, there's you know, there's some winning going on. And so I'm intrigued here because at this point, okay, so you've positioned yourself. I mean, is this a theme when you want to get into a negotiation? You're positioning yourself like the sexy redhead at the bar, you know, trying to get them to come over and flirt with you. Is that so? You joined War Room and you showed off your brilliance. You kept winning these Wicked Smart competitions and getting them, you know, come hither, Ryan, come to me. Is that the way you approach negotiations typically, or
no, not at all. I approach it as giving value. I don't approach it as, you know, I don't hold anything back. Like I said, I would give all of the time that I had to help them in any way that I could. And then they saw the value of having that as a more constant part and a more integral part of the business. And so they, you know, they presented that offer. So, you know, do I hope that will happen with good companies, with good people? Yeah, absolutely. But there isn't any tease or hold back or come hither. It's all just, hey, here's value. And when people decide that, like more of the time, then usually say, hey, what would it be like to get you involved in the company?
So, but at some point there must have been, the discussion, right? The, not necessarily the ask, but how do you, I mean, do you just did? I mean, let's pretend it's a different company because I wouldn't, you know, I don't want to start, you know, trying to probe for this analogy. There's no need to probe at the specifics of that particular deal.
Sure.
At some point, I mean, you're in a good position for a negotiation because the stakeholders are asking you to join their party. How do you decide what you're worth or what your stake should be, or how do you approach that particular issue?
It's a really good question. And the answer is that it usually presents itself by someone that might be transitioning out of the company. So in that company, there was a 1/3 stake that was available. So it was pretty easy to say, oh, well, we can be equal partners. That looks good to me. In the real estate company, there was the exit of a partner as well. I had helped advise the two principals in helping work out a founder that, you know, wanted to do other things. And so a spot opened up. And so there was a portion of that equity that they wanted to recapture for themselves. There was a portion that they wanted to give to some other folks in the company that had been heavy contributors. And then the remaining interest was enough that it was of interest to me to come in. So I'm trying to think, in all of the situations that I can think of, it's really not been me saying I need to have X. It's been, this is what's available. And because of other transactions or other equity that's opened up, and then I can step into that. And for me, I think it's basically, if it's 5% or less, it's as an advisor. If it's between 5% and 20%, it's likely that I'm not interested unless it's a really significant dollar amount associated with that. And then at 20%. To 45 or 50%, I'm very interested in that. So that's kind of where the sweet spots are. Either less than five, I'm an advisor, or between 20 and 50, and you know, I'm a significant part of the company.
Like that. And so as an advisor, what is typically your input in terms of time spent, or what you're giving in return?
Yeah, the difference between being an advisor and like generally helping for free is that I'm actively thinking about relationships that I can create for the company, people that I can introduce them to, being plugged into the inside workings of the company. So that it's a more formal thing in that you typically have four meetings a year. They might not be in person, they may be virtual, but you're top of mind for advisors. It's like you're for a company you're advising, you're how can I plug this company into everything else that I've already got? How can I plug this into my network? Who can I connect them to? That's you're actively thinking opposed to somebody messages you on Facebook and says, you know, hey, I'm thinking about this. What do you think about that? If I have time, I answer. If I don't have time, I say I don't have time right now. But I'm never thinking like person because they could be introduced to so and so. I'm not thinking about that because I got plenty on my plate, right? That's the difference.
That's fantastic.
Does that make sense?
It absolutely does. I was going to say that's absolutely clear, that distinction. That's very 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 clear. And so, how many companies roughly are you an advisor for at this point?
The total companies in that I have ownership in right now, which would include the advisor companies, is 36.
36. Just 36.
Well, Branson's got like 400, so I've got a long ways to go. I've got to catch up. But he's older than me, so I've got a few years. So.
And now, okay, I think I've just seen a little thread there to pull. At this point, I do want to just check, because we've definitely got the quickfire question round, but how are we doing for time your end?
Right, I've got about 15 more minutes.
15 minutes, okay. So I just want to clarify. Have you identified Branson potentially as your next stepping stone?
Yes, I have. And our strategy with that is, and I don't know if anything will come with it or not, but our strategy is paid channel of access. So we hired Richard to be the keynote, or I interviewed him, right, at Traffic and Conversion Summit, our big event. So we leveraged the budget and relationship of that event to have the introduction to him. And then part of the contract that I do whenever I do something like that is now I'm paid, right, a significant amount of money to have him come. And then part of the deal is always that we have time to chat at the event as well. So there's usually a 4-hour period. We have him on stage for 45. We do some sort of meet and greet. And then there's some time that we have in the green room to just talk. So that's always the first step. And then you get to know somebody and then you add value. So the next step will be either to go to the safari lodge thing that he does in Africa or go to Necker and spend a little bit more time with him in a small environment. And then if something bubbles up, you know, something bubbles up, we'll see.
I love it. And the podcast, what's the why behind your podcast?
It's 100% passion project, give back. I want to take people who are real entrepreneurs, who are not fake Instagram successes, who I know are successful, and let them share their entrepreneurial journey with people, including the hard, difficult starting times and the stuff that they're facing along with the successes and what were the things that were pivotal, similar to what you're doing, because I want people to see what it's like to be an entrepreneur and see that wherever they are right now is just fine. And here are the places that a lot of people who are very well-known successful entrepreneurs have been, introduce them to other people who I think are up-and-comers as well, and share things that will really help them to be successful as they go through their journey and to not feel alone in the journey, and also to not feel like they're not moving fast enough.
That's incredible. And the name, for anyone that's curious, is Business Lunch with Roland Fraser, and it is an incredible podcast. You should absolutely subscribe and binge it twice.
Thank you.
Okay, twice. So I have tons more to ask you, but we have this quick fire question round, which often pulls out some insights. So okay. I'll ask it as quick as I can, and we'll see what comes. You have no idea what's coming as well, just for the folks at home. So here we go. Let's hit. Are there any unusual things you eat or drink regularly, and why?
Are there unusual things? Unusual. Well, I mean, I like sushi and I like wine, so I do those quite a bit. No, I don't think so, but I'm not afraid of unusual foods, and I've had pretty much everything you can think of. So I do seek out unusual foods when I'm in a different place, like in Iceland, having puffin and horse. That's an unusual thing, right? But it's not unusual there. So yeah. I like to seek out unique things in different cultures and experience them.
Nice. How do you get yourself into a state of flow?
It's a really good question. I think that it is a positioning. So I remember I was not in a state of flow when I met my wife, and I told her, I said, it's all about the flow. When you're in the flow, things just wash over you. Opportunities are limitless. And you just have to find the current. It's like an ocean. You just have to find the current, and you have to position yourself in front of it. So for me, it is, I actively seek relationships outside of, you know, being behind the computer. I think that especially digital entrepreneurs have a tendency to say, you know, oh, all the big stuff, I got to work on this Facebook campaign, or I've got to, you know, do this podcast episode or whatever. But it's not, that's not how it works. So I put myself in the flow by owning businesses that lead to putting myself in the flow. So digital marketer, I'm in touch with, you know, a million plus marketers. Through the Warren Mastermind, I've got 200 businesses, about 50 of them that are doing over $100+ million a year. 3 of them are doing over $1 billion a year. That's really good flow, because I am positioned as, you know, the one that curates that group of people. And so they come to me and they refer me other people. In the real estate business, same thing. So and then going to events. And while I'm not what I would consider an extrovert by any means, I do like people. And it seems that there are always people who I know who are introducing me to other people. So I think it's just to get into the flow for me is to actively seek out relationships, actively seek out up and comers, actively target people who are ahead of where I am, like Branson, and figure out how do I pull them into my world or myself into their world by adding value and working those relationships tirelessly.
Love that. Wow. Okay. What habit or opinion do you have that other people tend to disagree with?
I don't believe that you have to grind. I just posted on this. I really don't like, I like Gary Vee. I did not think that I was going to like him, but he spoke at our event a few years back, and I met him and had dinner with him. And my wife was like, you need to go down and talk to him. We're at like a table with, you know, 12 people, and there was a spot down there. She's like, you need to go talk to him. I was like, yeah, I don't think so. And she's like, no, you really need it. I was like, fine. So I went down and I forgot completely that he's like a wine nut. So we were in a wine room full of wine. And so we started talking about that, but his persona, I can only watch a little bit of it, but I just don't like the grumpy grind. We're always working thing. I don't like titles like Rise and Grind, even though I like Damon John. I think he's a brilliant entrepreneur, or Grant Cardone, you know, who has done amazing things. These are all people that have had great success in their fields. But I think that the message to the rest of the world of grind, this unpleasant, you've just got to do it all the time and there's no breaks, is not the healthiest way to be as an entrepreneur. So I am anti-grind. That's my antithesis statement and position.
Would you say potentially the opposite of grind is smart, like work smart
rather leveraged than work hard, potentially? I think it's
work
leveraged. Yes,
option
because
number three.
Leveraged means that you can accomplish all of the things that, you know, I say outsource your grind, right? So outsource the things that are the grind, because you will find a way to sabotage yourself if you're doing things that you are not happy doing that feel grindy to you. Then get a contractor, an employee, or a partner and let them do the grind, because they probably like that. The biggest thing somebody told me the other day, it's like, I never really thought about that. I wouldn't outsource stuff that I didn't like doing because I thought it was doing a disservice because somebody else would have this thing they didn't like. I'm like, no way. There are people that love doing the stuff you don't like. I have partners that absolutely love doing stuff that I hate, and I love doing stuff that they hate, right? That's a good partnership. And if you can't get a partner, then get a contractor. If you can't get a contractor, get an employee. You do not have to grind. So I'm very, very passionate about that. I just think it's, I think the opposite of it is outsource and leverage. If you are grinding and you have to do all of this work, there's probably a different path that is a leveraged path that doesn't require you to do that. And one of the ways that you can leverage is by having other people do it.
I love that. I always say if you don't enjoy doing it, or you can pay someone less than your hourly rate to do it, outsource it either by software or people, right?
And my partner, yeah. Ryan has a good saying. So if you're worried about automation, you're like, well, I don't know how to do this automation and software is so hard. It's like, it is automated if you don't have to do it. So if you can hire somebody to do it, it is still automated.
I love that. If you ran a school but you could only teach one non-traditional lesson, what would that be?
One non-traditional lesson meaning like a course of study, or one lesson meaning like one particular?
Like a subject matter. Or interpret it how you like, if that leads to a better answer.
It would probably be how to think better. How to think in terms of models, and then how to create a lattice work of models that serve you and what you're doing. Maybe a better way to say it would be frameworks than models. I like frameworks. So I think that if you can boil something down into component parts and then mix-mosh them all around to figure out what's the sequence of those components that will serve you the best, you have a framework that you can apply so that you don't have to rethink every situation that you come into contact with. And I think a lot of people get stuck in just doing stuff and not really ever taking the time to step back and say, how can I frameworkize this? How can I modelize this? And then how do all of those frameworks or models fit together to help me move faster in the world?
And so are there any books or resources that you would recommend for people to find that step one towards becoming a Zen frameworker?
hopefully mine as soon as it comes out, but it's more reading. I get tremendous amount of that kind of stuff from reading like Charlie Munger, who works with Warren Buffett. He has a book called Charlie Munger's Almanac. Reading annual reports from Amazon that Bezos is talking about, or Buffett, reading books on logic, those are things that help. Elon Musk talks a lot about that kind of stuff. So to me, I haven't seen like a good resource on it. There probably is one, but I haven't found it yet.
Okay. What book leads into this? What book had the biggest impact on your life, or books? As I feel like as an avid reader, you might have more than one.
The biggest impact on my life. The biggest impact on my life was probably a combination of Think and Grow Rich, How to Win Friends and Influence People, and The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. But I'd say on business, it would be a book called Black Box Thinking, which is on failure. John Doerr's book called Measure What Matters, which is a relatively recent book. Business Adventures, which was both Bill Gates and Warren Buffett's favorite book that they carry around all the time everywhere. And there was another one recently. The Goal, I think is Eliyahu Goldwaite or something like that, Goldwaite, wow. Which is all about the theory of constraints.
Amazing. I've just scribbled those down like a first grader. I was in such a rush to get them done. where do you go or what do you do to get inspired?
I am inspired all the time, every single day. So I think that I find inspiration in thinking about the things that I'm grateful for, and then thinking about the things that I am yet to accomplish that are causing me to continue to be hunger. So I'm inspired by those things. By being grateful, I get to be inspired by things that I already have in my life and not take them for granted. And then by looking at the places that I want to go moving forward, I'm inspired by the drive and desire and hunger to get to those places to accomplish the things, to then future pace myself by thinking, how am I going to feel when I've affected these people, or I've made these changes, or, you know, I've achieved this particular thing.
Fantastic. And do you have a specific morning routine that incorporates the gratitude?
I do. Yeah. Yeah. I'm always, it's three things, and it's really funny. I've kind of honed it. It's one thing that I would absolutely take for granted. Like, for example, the ability to walk. Think about, like, I think it's really weird because you can be grateful for monetary things, but like being grateful for the ability to think logically, or the ability to smell or see. And I think those should be on regular rotation, because there are lots of people that don't have those things. And what if you were to lose it? My wife was telling me just a couple days ago about a friend of hers who dove into the ocean and broke her neck and was paralyzed. And she was this, you know, beautiful, amazing person that had, you know, all of these physical abilities, and then she lost them all. And that could happen to any of us at any moment. So I think being grateful for some gift that you have that is very basic, that you wouldn't think about, is very helpful. Then the second thing is usually some familial or relationship thing. I'm grateful for this person, to have this person in my life, or I'm grateful, for example, I didn't have any kids of my own. My wife had two children when we met. So, you know, the other day it was, I'm grateful for having the opportunity to be a parent, even though sometimes it's a freaking nightmare. But I'm grateful for the opportunity and the experience to do that. And then the next thing is usually some other thing. So, you know, and I'll try to do, I'll just try to pick some cool thing in my life or cool person in my life. But if I've got that person thing for sure, and usually a family thing as the second base, and a really basic thing as the first base, and the third base is kind of a wild card, that's kind of where I've come down on that. Then I do, I try to do at least 5 minutes, 15 is ideal, of meditation, just to picture nothingness, to breathe, and then any thought that comes in, just kind of send it away, like put a label on it and then send it out. And then I try to think about, who is someone that I don't understand that I could empathize with? And that's kind of my morning thing. Then I go into, what am I going to get done? Which is just, what three things am I going to accomplish today? Because if you just identify three things that you're going to accomplish, you're going to finish today, then you're so far ahead of most people. Like, I mean, you really are. It's kind of stunning. But if you can, and it's not as easy as you think, too, to get those three things done. You pick them, but then life is there in the whirlwind that it is in your face, trying to take all of your attention and all of the people who need all of the things they need from you. So if you can accomplish those three things every single day, you're getting pretty far ahead in even just a week. That's 21 things that you accomplished, right?
Absolutely. And are you waking up at a consistent time every day, or is it just, you know?
No, it's a range, but it's early. It's usually between 4 a.m. and 5:30 a.m.
Wow. And is that the legal degree that's just stayed with you, or like, how
no.
did that come about?
Yeah, no, I've always been early, but it's just, I get so much done. So I find that there's nobody else that's up at that time. So I think I read a book years ago about, I think at the time it was Michael Milken, who didn't end up turning out as great as I would have hoped he would have. But it was just the whole thing that there's this whole rest of the coast. So he was a successful guy. He invented junk bonds. He was, you know, investment banker type. And he was in California, not in New York. And New York was up at 8, 9 at least. So 9 is 6. So he would get up at 4 or 5 every day, because he had stuff going on in the East Coast. And if we're in a global world, then, you know, I want to be at least within my own country up at the time when stuff is going on the East Coast. So that kind of was, you know, long ago, something that I thought about, even though I didn't really have anything to get up for. And then it just kind of became, it's this quiet time that allows me to get up, go through my morning ritual thing, work out, you know, get bathed and showered and all those sorts of things. And then I'm ready with all of that done, plus probably emails and social responded to by 9. And that feels really good, which then leaves me so much freer in the rest of the day to have connections with people, which is the thing that I think is, you know, probably the most valuable.
And do you have any advice for how you extended your day to you trained yourself to be up so early? Because presumably you're still going to bed at a, you know, the same time as everybody else as well, right?
Yeah, I am. I heard a really good Ed Milet, who has a great podcast, super smart, super successful guy. He expressed it very well. He spoke at one of our events and he said that he divides each day into 3 days, that there's the morning time from, you know, I think he said from like 5 to 10, that's 5 hour block. And then it's the afternoon time from 11 to 5. And then there's the evening time from 7 to 10 or 11. And so he's basically, I got 3 days for every 1 day of yours. And I kind of feel like that. I don't think I have three, but I think I have 2 days for the average. So it just divides itself naturally for me into morning routines, catch up stuff, then relationship stuff, and then agreements stuff at night, because I have lots of documents and stuff like that. So I think that enables you to move faster than almost everybody else on the planet.
Amen. If I gave you $5,000, how would you double it in 24 hours?
How would I double $5,000? Gosh, the easiest thing for me, if I was only $5,000, probably the easiest thing for me would be to go out and there's so many things that are for sale that are so undervalued. It's just a straight arbitrage. So I'd probably go to the consignment store and find some amazing thing that somebody has dumped off that they just wanted to get rid of in a wealthy area of town, because usually those people have really nice things. And then I would buy it. And how long do I have to do it?
24 hours.
Then I'd probably put it on Craigslist, or I'd take it to a jewelry shop or something like that. That'd be the easiest way. It'd be a straight arbitrage, buy low, sell high thing.
And presumably it's not the same answer if I said 5 million?
No, I would have a harder time doing 5 million in 24 hours would be tricky. That would be tricky to double 5 million in 24 hours. That might be a limiting belief that I have. I'm not sure I could do that right now. I need to up-level my skills for that.
It's a phone, Branson. Branson, yeah, exactly. Yeah, got a question point. Okay, what's the best advice ever given to you?
The best advice ever given to me, I believe it was a tolerance thing or an understanding, empathy thing. My father gave it to me, and he said that just remember that people frequently say things when they're mad that they do not mean. So it allows you to give people a lot of leeway. So if you hear somebody saying something bad about you, number one, listen only if you hear it directly. Because if you hear somebody telling you that somebody said something bad about you, there's a filter on it and maybe an agenda. But but especially know that, you know, we are different people with different feelings all throughout the day. And so it's a consistency of behavior, not a particular single incidence that should define how you feel about somebody or how you think somebody feels about you.
Wow. I might completely steal that if someone asked me that question now.
I like it.
What silly things should people do more of?
People should do silly things more. They should be silly. They should not be worried about how they look to other people. They should just do what makes them feel good. I think that's a huge thing, is worrying about what other people think about you. So the ability to be silly so that people are surprised that someone like you would be silly, and then eventually they're no longer surprised that you would be silly, is a wonderful thing.
Absolutely. How would you convince someone to do something good that they didn't want to do?
That they didn't want to do? Do something good that they didn't want to do. I find persuasion and negotiation to be quite an art. So I think it's like painting a painting. I tell people this all the time, because negotiation, I am reputed to be fairly good at it, and I really enjoy it, and I have studied it. So it would basically be, I end up doing it all the time. But it's to identify the things that are important to them and then to plant in them the idea that doing the thing that they don't want to do that would be good for them or other people is actually going to achieve for them the things that are important to them. That sounds kind of convoluted, but it really isn't. If you can identify what's important to people, then all you have to do is build a bridge between the things that are important to them and the thing that they don't necessarily want to do, and show them how doing that thing serves them on the things that they want to do, and then they'll do it every time. And if it is their idea, or if they perceive it to be their idea because of how you've led them to that conclusion, then it's even easier.
Even better. All right, penultimate question. Would you rather fight one horse-sized duck or 100 duck-sized horses?
Horse-sized duck or 100? Gosh, I would probably choose the horse-sized duck.
Why?
Well, I think that it would be easier to defeat a single opponent than 100 opponents, depending on the power of the other ducks. So I like the just defeating the one instead of having to defeat all the others.
Okay. All right. Well, think of me when you dream about that giant beak and wings tonight.
Because I used to have lots of birds, I know that ducks are soft bills, so the bite can't hurt. So there's no harm in their mouth, and then they've only got their wings and 2 feet to work with. So I'm feeling pretty good about the balance situation.
I love that. All right, the final question, Roland. You've been amazing throughout. The final question is, what makes you the happiest?
The happiest thing for me is truly helping other people. I just dig it, man. I like solving challenges that other people have, and helping them see different ways of seeing things. It's absolutely when I feel the best.
Fantastic. Why? I mean, I feel the exact same. I mirror that exact feeling, but why?
I have no idea. I don't know what leads you to that. I just remember that the first time that I ever shared as a child in a way that was more advantageous to the other person, I broke a bar of chocolate in half when I was sitting with two other friends in my yard. And as a kid, this is a really, really young thing. And I gave the bigger portion to the person that I was splitting my piece of candy with, and it felt great. And I just haven't changed since then. And that image of that day still stays with me. So I know that it's just a good feeling. It's a good feeling to make other people happy, because the smile on their face is, you know, you can't buy that, you know?
That's hands down best answer so far. Sorry, other guests. Amazing. I might beep that whole bit so people just think I'm swearing. Really just to
like it.
Roland, you've been incredible. I have filtered, frankly, the questions and the follow-ups to try and be as respectful as possible of your time. But I truly am incredibly grateful for everything you've shared, the insight, the wisdom, the experience, the value, the bombs, the skates that you've shared in this podcast. It's been truly amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Have you got any asks or requests of the audience listening or watching today?
You already mentioned I would love if people like the stuff that I talk about to come to Business Lunch Podcast and listen. It's on iTunes and all the other places you would find those. I would love if people would like to be better marketers, for them to come to our Traffic and Conversion Summit.com and think about coming to one of our events, or digitalmarketer.com to learn about that kind of training. And if they have any questions or follow-up, I'm on social pretty much everywhere as /Roland Frazier. So happy to answer any questions that I can in any way.
Fantastic. Roland, once again, thank you so much for your time and everything you've done, everything that you put out into the community. And
thank you.
The way you are, please continue trying to educate people to be more like Roland. And if you ever create a little bracelet that says "Be More Roland," make sure you tell me where to buy one.
Then I will have lost my humility, and you should definitely not listen to me at that point. Thanks, man. I appreciate you having me on.
Thank you so much. Hey, Martin here again with an audio goodie bag of a bonus before you head off. First up, I hope you enjoyed this episode, and if you did, please subscribe and follow Smarter Destiny across iTunes, YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram. It really helps spread our message, and you'll get valuable content along the way too. Secondly, if you have an e-commerce business or are thinking of starting one, grab a copy of my new book, 1% Secret, recommended by Kevin Harrington and a host of other elite guys. Even better, it's free. Just help out with the shipping cost. So head to smarterdestiny.com/book to grab your free copy. Thanks so much, and I'll see you on the next episode.